I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Abigail Pogrebin, journalist and author of the ongoing newspaper series 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew, and The Stars of David, book and musical. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking about the nature of Jewish life here in America, how it's changed in recent years. When I was growing up, say, 40 or so years ago, the fixtures of American Jewish life were the synagogues, conservative, reformer Orthodox, the Jewish community centers, non-denominational, but Jewish culturally and athletically and by membership, and Israel-oriented organizations like B'nai B'rith and Hadassah, Histadrut, Ort, and the Pioneer Women. There were subsets of all of these, such as the Sisterhood and Men's Club and youth groups at synagogues, the B'nai B'rith women, and there were other institutions that were critical for part of the year or for some sectors of the Jewish community, like Jewish camps for the young, Jewish day schools, primarily for Orthodox kids, Hillel for college kids, and Jewish old age homes for the elderly. And, of course, there were Jewish hospitals. But in essence, the synagogues, JCCs, and Israel organizations were the pillars of Jewish life. Jews were very active in charitable work for social good, but often they chose to do this through Jewish charities. Feeding the Jewish hungry, caring for the Jewish underprivileged, Jewish family services for broken families and for counseling children, scholarships to higher education for Jewish students, building hospitals or orphanages in Israel through Jewish organizations. Jews cared about Jewish causes very much. They also cared about society as a whole, don't get me wrong, but they knew that they had to help Jewish causes first because no one else would. It was a primary responsibility. This Jewish community infrastructure was in part supported by the fundraising undertaken by the organizations themselves, sometimes with assistance from the Jewish Federation movement, called then the United Jewish Appeal, which mostly raised money for Israel and rarely did anything for synagogues. They still don't really. And sometimes organizations were simply supported by donations and bequests by individuals and for individuals. The Jewish community in those days was not as affluent as it is today. It was mostly the children of first-generation immigrants from Europe. Anti-Semitism was a very serious problem, and the survival of Israel was a principal concern for most American Jews of every denomination or movement. Conservative rabbis came from only one seminary. Reform rabbis from one of two campuses of the same seminary. There was lots of disagreement within the Jewish world, of course. Some things don't change. But that rough organization of the communal structure is what prevailed. Now, fast forward 40 years or so, and things have changed. In spite of many efforts to declare them irrelevant, past their prime, dated, out of touch, etc., and to replace them with something shiny and new, the primary Jewish organizations, synagogues, JCCs, and Israel organizations are still around, but in somewhat modified form. Today, synagogues, temples, congregations provide an array of programs besides prayer, religious school, and life cycle events. There are preschools, adult education, day schools, counseling services, social action programs, youth groups, community advocacy, and, of course, Israel programming. JCCs, after nearly disappearing under the competition from newer health clubs and sports facilities, have made a comeback by welcoming non-Jewish members in larger and larger numbers. Israel is a well-established fact, of course, and the pro-Israel organizations have turned often to political action. Groups like AIPAC or its newer competitor J Street, and to supporting specific kinds of political or social programs in Israel or even in the United States. Birthright Israel has now carved a significant place on the national scene by replacing the trip to Israel with parents or youth groups with a 9-day college peer experience. Jewish organizations that target smaller niche needs like retirement homes and counseling and social work services continue to exist. Some have grown more focused and effective, some less so. And new Jewish organizations aimed at trendier, new Jewish-oriented projects, the environment, food sustainability, LGBT rights, and the like, have found a place as well. As so often happens, the need-based charitable organizations that were started in order to solve communal problems have morphed into permanent entities that raise money and now cater to many non-Jews. And the Federation system, founded to raise funds for Israel and then for local Jewish causes, has struggled over the years and has become in some communities an end in itself, providing programming that actually competes with synagogues and other Jewish organizations in the interests of creating allegiances that will result in more dollars being given to the Federation. You know, fundraising for the sake of more fundraising. And new organizations and programs designed to reach and slightly involve not very committed Jews seek to create an amorphous reason to be kind of a little Jewish. You know, just not too Jewish. But perhaps the most important change is that today Jews no longer think of Jewish activities, Jewish community, or Jewish causes first. We Jews remain highly active, hugely active, in fact, in charities and in the community. We give at a very high level, just not necessarily for or to Jewish causes. Universities and arts programs and social action causes and political support often come before Jewish donations. And while the current wisdom says that our American Jewish community population is stable at somewhere around 6 million Jews, perhaps even growing a little, there's no sense that it is deepening in commitment or activity, at least not across the board, in some Jewish way. All of which makes this a very interesting time to be a Jewish professional, you know, like a rabbi, or to have a Jewish radio show. And yet, Judaism has so much to offer the world today, so much meaning and purpose and innovation. I don't have a crystal ball. As the prophet Isaiah said, Lo Navi velo ben Navi, I am not a prophet or even the son of a prophet, although I am actually a rabbi and the son and grandson of rabbis. Anyway, I do know there is nothing more interesting, challenging, and exciting than living a committed Jewish life. And so, to play us in, here's Doug Kotler singing Jewish USA for our national community in transition.
If everybody had a Torah across the USA, then everybody'd be Jewish like you and me today. You'd see them wearing a tallit in shul on Saturday. If everybody was if everybody was Jewish, Jewish USA, the Easter Bunny and Santa would have a holiday. No ham and cheese on white bread with lots of mayonnaise. And the spirit of the Jaga
That was Doug Kotler's Jewish USA, a silly exploration of Jewish identity, or at least one variation of it, in our open, interesting, dynamic, vibrant, complex American Jewish community of 2015. Speaking of Jewish identity, I first encountered Abigail Pogrebin in print in her excellent revealing book, The Stars of David, which included terrific, extensive interviews with many of the most prominent Jews in America, from the media to arts to government. She somehow had access to everyone, it seemed, perhaps because of her extensive experience producing at 60 Minutes, and she got them to talk about what Judaism means to them, or it doesn't. It was a great book. Her new project is perhaps even more interesting. Find out what it's all about when we come back soon with Abigail Pogrebin on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Abigail Pogrebin. She is an author of, I guess I first met her in her book, The Stars of David, Prominent Jews Talk About Being Jewish, which was a great exploration of what it meant to be Jewish way back in 2005. She has written consistently in a variety of forms, had books made into plays on Broadway, and is working on a pretty fascinating project, exploring the holidays throughout the Jewish world. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about what it's like to do, was it 18 holidays?
18 holidays, one wandering Jew, if you get the play on words.
Yes.
Instead of the wandering Jew.
Where did the idea come from, and how's it working?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of calling it extreme sport Judaism. And basically what I'm doing, you know, it sounds, I don't mean to make it sound like a gimmick, because it came from a very real place, which is, you know, I look at Jews who live by the Jewish year, where the calendar is really the scaffolding of a Jewish life. And I wanted to understand it because, you know, there are all those jokes about how there's a Jewish holiday every minute. But it really is true. There's a lot of them. And at the same time, for people who observe them, they describe them as having great resonance and importance. I wanted to kind of, you know, as they say in Harry Met Sally, I wanted to have what they were having and get a taste of it for myself as a Jew that I would consider half in, half out.
So I particularly enjoyed one of your articles, which was, I think I saw it in the foreword, about the, how can I say this delicately, the sexuality of the lulav and the etrog, which is not something, I mean, I'm a rabbi, I've been a congregational rabbi for more than 20 years, I have a little experience here, I've never heard that reference in a whole Jewish life.
Well, you know, with every one of these holidays, what I do is kind of research very deeply, and then write about it before the holiday happens, and then once I've experienced the holiday, I write about sort of the post-holiday dispatch. All of them are for the Jewish forward, as you mentioned. And for the Sukkot, a number of rabbis actually talked about the pagan kind of original ritual of waving the lulav and etrog, And yes, it got more explicit than I expected when Michael Paley, who's at Federation in New York, described, and I think he got a little heat for the description, but he wasn't the only one who talked about the erotic imagery of the lulav and etrog. And you know, it's what my cantor at my synagogue called that column 50 Shades of Sukkot.
Somehow it seems appropriate. Your work, at least the Jewish aspects of your work, which are a very important part of it, seem to me to be about exploring various different ways of being Jewish in this world today. What led you down that path originally?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short version is just that, you know, my mother was raised very observant, and she turned her back on Jewish observance after she had a seminal, very difficult moment. Her mother died when my mother was 15 of cancer. And my mother, who was a very educated Jew for her time in the 1940s, and had a bat mitzvah, which was rare at that time for girls, she could not recite the mourner's Kaddish.
Right.
Only because she was female. So she really was so angry at that moment that she turned her back on the tradition, didn't give it to us. I have a twin sister and a brother, so I didn't go to Hebrew school. We didn't belong to a synagogue. We did go to high holiday services somewhere. We did have Shabbat. But it's, you know, it's a condensed way of saying I really was missing the education of all this, the things that you got that's in your DNA was not in mine. And, you know, I went off to Yale, and I dabbled in a little bit in Jewish studies, took Jewish literature, took a Hebrew class, really felt the absence of that knowledge, but felt like it was too late to make up for it. And then I had a son. And going through that bris, which I think for many parents this happens, was kind of a, you know, one of those watershed moments where you say, could I explain this to him? Could I actually translate what it means to be a Jew, or why we went through this ceremony? And simultaneous, or very soon after that, I started Stars of David, where I interviewed, as you said, 62 famous American Jews, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Steven Spielberg, Natalie Portman, about how much they cared about Jewish ritual or tradition. And it was really stunning to me how many of them had let it go or didn't feel like it was a priority in their lives, and it made me want to go in the other direction, which was to really understand it. And so the deeper I got in studying Torah and taking classes and auditing at various places, it's like, you know, I'm sure the more you get, the more you want.
Right.
The more you learn, the more you want to learn.
You're now the poster child for Too Jewish. We will talk much more with Abby Pogroman about her work now and what it's like to write a book and see it become a musical when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country, the only place in the world certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Yesterday was the ultimate Hallmark holiday, Valentine's Day, a festival based on pagan and Christian traditions, and clearly not something good Jews need to observe. Valentine's Day is actually based on early Christian figures, or a figure named Valentine. The most likely candidate for this was a priest in Rome who happened to be buried February 14th in the year 496, by the way. His story is also linked to an earlier man named Valentine in the town of Terni, who was supposed to have been martyred by the Roman Emperor Aurelian in that year. The tradition arose, not much based on fact, that this Valentine helped persecuted Christians and was martyred for doing so. The holiday that evolved became a lover's festival in the Middle Ages when courtly love was so revered. In any case, Valentine's Day is really, really not a natively Jewish holiday. But try telling that to your wife or significant other and see just how far that gets you. Well, our good friend Rabbi Joe Black has a very clever song on that very silly subject.
Valentine's Day is not a Jewish holiday. That's why I didn't buy you flowers. I was thinking just of you. I know you're proud to be a Jew. It's a most confusing 24 hours. No, I can't be what I ain't. And a day named for a saint doesn't seem to be a kosher celebration. Oh, but when Purim comes, we'll nash on special heart-shaped Hamantaschen and drink Mulligan David wine for our libation. It's a Hallmark holiday, that is all that I can say. I don't know why you think it's so essential. Besides, at $80 a pop, a dozen roses ain't so high. What's the point of getting oh so sentimental? No, I didn't buy Godivas, 'cause the increase in your dress sizes from eating chocolate makes you weep and makes you wail. So open up the bedroom door, don't make me sleep here on the floor. I'll buy perfume for you next week when it's on sale.
Joe Black singing Valentine's Day is not a Jewish holiday. I forgot to ask Joe what his wife Sue thinks of that song. We welcome our Mivi Nahon Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So yesterday was Valentine's Day here in America, which is the festival of love. It's based on pagan and Christian associations. In Israel, they don't do Valentine's Day, and they don't do it this time of year, but they do something a little different called Tu B'Av. Can we talk about Valentine's Day and Tu B'Av a little bit?
Yeah, and actually, Valentine's Day is being celebrated also, you know, in a very modest way, also in Tel Aviv.
In Tel Aviv, of course, it would start in Tel Aviv, naturally.
Yeah, and I remember then when we used to live in Tel Aviv, Eli and me, so we celebrate, kind of, you know, it's another...
You go to dinner.
Yeah, yeah.
He brings you flowers?
Yes. But in Israel, we are celebrated much more, like greatly, the Israeli and Jewish Valentine's Day, which is Tu B'Av. Tu B'Av, it's in the middle of summer. And usually there is a lot of festival, and it used to be even bigger festival in Tzemach, in Yam HaMelech, in all kind of places.
So the Dead Sea and different parts of Israel.
I don't know if they remembered, if they read the Megillat Rut, or if they remembered why Boaz went to, you know, I don't know if
yeah,
they
the
remember.
Great love stories of the Bible. Maybe they read a little Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, and the story of Boaz and Ruth, one of the really great sexy love stories.
And the purpose of the day, why they dressed white, where, you know, the purpose of Tu B'Av, because in our Torah it says there is no greatest simcha like Tu B'Av, right?
Yeah, it does. It's very interesting in the
by
Talmud.
By the way, it says Tu B'Av and Yom HaKippurim.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but...
Well, I can tell you why. This is an interesting question. Tu B'Av was this date when couples matched up or they celebrated their love.
Conflicts were solved
all conflict was resolved. So the connection to Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, the fast day of the Day of Atonement, is the afternoon of Yom Kippur. It says in the Talmud, in the courtyard, the outer courtyard of the temple, that's when single men and single women used to be able to meet, and that's when matchmaking took place. Because by then, the Kohen Gadol had come out of the Holy of Holies, and the most dramatic and traumatic time of the Day of Atonement was over, and there was a sense of relief, even though there was still some daylight left, and the day wasn't over, and so that's when the matchmaking took place. And
you know,
so
Rabbi, it's very interesting.
That's the connection.
The man is very hungry. didn't take a shower for 24 hours. Like, you know, I don't know if he can make a real decision.
He can't use any, he can't use any perfumes. The woman can't use any, you know,
strange,
gold or silver jewelry.
Strange time of the year to make, it's anyway.
Well, maybe you see how people really are. I don't know. It might be the right time. So even without celebrating Valentine's Day, just remember, if you missed Valentine's Day yesterday, you didn't get your beloved anything, you have a special pass.
Who said that he needs to bring me flowers? Maybe I brought him flowers.
Well, I'm just saying you. It could be a woman, of course, who forgot to bring her boyfriend or husband the right thing. You can make it up at Tu B'Av, which is coming in July.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Ashrat. We'll talk next week.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We were talking about anti-Semitism in a variety of places around the world, including the Far East. And you mentioned last week the country of Indonesia, maybe the largest predominantly Muslim country in the world by population, I think, although there are more Muslims in India, but Indonesia is a majority Muslim. Let's talk, is there the same kind of anti-Semitism in a non-Arab Muslim country very far from the Middle East that you would expect to find in a Muslim country next to Israel or in that general vicinity?
Right. Well, most of the Arab countries have been at war with Israel to one degree or another since 1948, and many Arabs feel a genuine sense of kinship with the Palestinians, who they feel were victimized and evicted.
Arabs, fellow Arabs,
right.
Too. Right.
So one thing you mentioned last week about Muslim countries in Africa showing sometimes some high rates of anti-Semitism is a bit surprising, because they were enslaved in many cases or exploited or colonized by Arabs, and you wouldn't expect them to feel much sympathy for the Arabs of Palestine or anywhere else for that matter. Indonesia is another question, and as you point out, yes, it's the largest mostly Muslim country in the world. Most Americans think that it is the largest Muslim country in the world because of the CNN canard in the days, weeks, and months following 9/11, where CNN consistently referred to Indonesia as the largest Muslim country in the world. So thanks to you for just pointing out that, in fact, the largest population of Muslims in the world is in India by far, where they constitute a minority, but a very sizable minority, somewhere between 20 and 30% of a population that is somewhere around 1.5 billion.
Yeah, enormous population.
Right. So at a minimum, there's 300 million people there, who are Muslims, which is more people than there are altogether in Indonesia, which is only about 80% Muslim.
Right.
But they are definitely a majority in Indonesia, and Indonesia is the largest country which has a majority Islamic population.
I'm glad we could mutually clear that up for the world.
Right. Okay, so I personally have never run into anti-Semitism in Indonesia, but I've also never made a point of telling any Indonesians that I was Jewish. However, I recently spent an hour discussing this very subject, believe it or not, with a Jewish friend in New York who's very overtly Jewish and who actually left Russia because of his Jewishness and a few other factors, and travels quite a bit. And he makes it a habit of taking the political and sort of social, cultural, whatever, temperature, pulse of a country by talking with taxi drivers. And he said that every taxi driver he talked to in Jakarta was violently anti-Israel, if not also anti-Semitic. And most of them failed to make any distinction between Jews and Israelis. So the idea that American Jews were not Israelis, or that some Israelis are not Jews, just didn't fly with these taxi drivers at all. Now, this guy's sample may be of limited size and limited validity. I'm sure the ADL survey is much more worthwhile, but anecdotally, it surprised me that a country as far removed from the Palestinian conflict as Indonesia and facing such different issues would articulate strong feelings about Israel and or Jews. But they did, apparently, repeatedly.
No, I think that's right. It's fascinating how widespread this is when you think about Israel's a small country, very far away, not important in any way to Indonesia, or to many of the places where you see these sentiments expressed. It's really, really hard to understand in some fundamental way. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back here on Too Jewish, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A young Jewish guy gets a crush on a woman, but when he tells his father about her, his dad wants to know her family name. The son tells his dad that the woman's name is Christensen, and the father tells him that Christensen is certainly not a good Jewish name. He must forget her and go and find a nice Jewish girl. Time passes, the son finds another woman. Her name is Bush. His father tells him the same thing. Find a nice Jewish girl with a nice Jewish name. More time passes, the son finds another woman. This time he's sure he has solved the problem, because the woman's name is Goldberg. Goldberg, says his father, ah, that makes me so happy. A real Jewish name. Dad asks, so what's her first name? Is it one of my favorite Jewish names, like Rachel or Rebecca? No, Dad, says his son, it's Whoopi. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In a mitzvah that's at the heart of Jewish religious experience today, our portion of Truma this week has God commanding the Israelites, Asuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham, make me a sanctuary, and I will dwell among you. With this statement, the book of Exodus moves from practical laws to ritual ones. The plans for the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first site of national worship, and the directions for building the Ark of the Covenant are explained and detailed. In order to create the new central shrine for prayer, the place which God's presence will actually inhabit, Moses calls on the people of Israel to donate materials from the best of what they have, what comes to be called a truma offering. And a remarkable thing happens. When the people are asked to donate gifts to build the holy structures needed to worship God, they come forward immediately and give much more than is required. Moses actually has to ask the Israelites to stop bringing so much gold and silver and so many precious fabrics. This marks the first and only time in history when a temple building campaign brought in more than was asked for or required. May it happen again sometime soon, perhaps to my temple. In any case, the word for this experience is truma, a free will offering, a gift to God out of the goodness of the heart. This generous free will offering is a powerful thing indeed. For when it is constructed, the tabernacle in the wilderness, built from such free generosity, immediately fills with God's presence. When we give freely of ourselves to our temples today, time, love, care, or funds, we seek to recreate that free will offering, the full gift of heart and hand of our ancestors in Moses' time. And when we succeed in doing so, we too bring God's presence and love into our lives. The great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai wrote beautifully and sensuously on the subject of the synagogue in his final book called Open, Closed, Open. I studied love in the sanctuary of my childhood. I sang Come, Sabbath Bride on Friday nights with a bridegroom's fervor. I practiced longing for the days of the Messiah. I conducted yearning drills for the days of yore that will not return. The cantor serenades his love out of the depths. Kaddish is recited over lovers who stay together. The male bird dresses up in a blaze of color, and we dress the rolled-up Torah in silken petticoats and gowns of embroidered velvet held up by narrow shoulder straps. And we kiss them as they are passed around the synagogue, stroking them as we pass. May we, like Yehuda Amichai, find love of God and holiness in our own sanctuaries today, and may we learn, like the Torah portion of Truma, to give freely from the heart. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Abigail Pogrebin, will fill us in on just what it's like to spend each Jewish holiday, and there are so many of them, in a different, vibrant Jewish community and setting. Her project, experiencing all the Jewish holidays and writing about them for the Foreword, is called 18 Jewish Holidays, One Wandering Jew. It's both delightful, as is she, and revealing. Find out how when we return in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the...
at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Sandy Seltzer.
The mysterious death in Argentina of prosecutor Alberto Nisman, whose body was discovered shortly before he was about to issue an arrest warrant for the Argentinian president, Cristina Fernandez Kirchner, for allegedly protecting Iran from responsibility in the 1994 bombing of the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, continues to make headlines in that country. After an investigation, Nisman's death, first labeled a suicide, was found to be murder. The president has insisted that neither she nor any members of her staff had anything to do with the bombing, which claimed 85 deaths, let alone Nisman's death. With the Israeli elections still over a month away, the latest polls indicate that 67% of young people in Israel between the ages of 18 and 25 define themselves as either right-wing or center-right-wing. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has declared that he will do all in his power to defeat any nuclear agreement between the West and Iran. We will, he said, continue to lead all international efforts to foil this bad and dangerous agreement. Pressure in Israel and this country, urging him to reconsider, continues to mount over Mr. Netanyahu's scheduled speech before a joint session of Congress in March. Already over 60 Democrats have indicated that they will boycott the speech, along with Vice President Joe Biden. In this regard, Israel's ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, has been publicly reprimanded by the administration for activities deemed undiplomatic. The Jewish community is also split. A growing number of leading Jewish figures, including the president of the Union for Reform Judaism, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, and the past chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, have called upon Mr. Netanyahu to cancel his visit as ill-timed and blatantly political. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world.
Our brothers, lawless of Israel.
We're delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Abigail Pogrebin. She was originally the author of Stars of David, a wonderful exploration about what Judaism means and doesn't mean in contemporary Judaism. She's now the author of a series for the Forward, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew, and has written also about what it's like to be a twin and explored many interesting things. Abby, tell us, you wrote Stars of David, and you talked about that earlier in the show, how you got everybody, I mean, really everybody to talk to you. Was the TV connection helpful? How did you manage to get all those folks?
It's a good question. It's kind of the question is how do you get to these people? And, I wrote the book in 2005. I don't honestly think I could write it today because the people that I got to now have not just two layers of people saying no. They have 10 layers of people
saying no.
Exactly. Posses and publicists and people weighing whether you should do Vanity Fair or the New York Times. You know, so a little schlepper like me coming along and saying, will you talk about your bat mitzvah? I don't think it would be high on their list. But basically, I was kind of dogged and also very respectful, obviously. And I think people in a funny way didn't realize what they were getting into. You sort of start with something like, tell me about your childhood Seder. And before you know it, Kenneth Cole is talking about marrying a Catholic and raising his children as Catholics and why that was very complicated for him later in life. Or you have Beverly Sills, the opera singer, who's sadly gone now, talking about how she had to put her deaf child in a Catholic school and solely because that was the best school for the deaf, but that was complicated for her. Or Steven Spielberg, who adopted a black child, saying how important it was to him that he see his black son have an Orthodox bar mitzvah. I mean, these are pretty intense, deep, surprising things that go way beyond, you know, did you like gefilte fish? And what happened, I think, as you know, is that you ask, you know, if Mike Wallace says yes and Sarah Jessica Parker says yes, then, you know, Natalie Portman will say yes because she thinks that she's in good company.
Right.
Or Larry King will say yes. You know, I mean, I built on a very small list that got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I still had some no's. And, of course, because I'm Jewish, I took all the rejections personally.
You still remember every one of them. You have the letters up in the closet.
Every one of them. Yeah.
It's a great book, still useful. And, you know, it's almost a decade and yet still speaks to what it's like to be Jewish and how that matters for people. So how did it become a musical?
I know. It's crazy. You know, I think it's just what you said. And if you allow me a moment of immodesty, I don't think it's just that this book is not a Q&A. This is Stars of David. I really took you in the room with me. You know, I took you to breakfast when I met Dustin Hoffman.
I loved that one, by the way. I really, really enjoyed
it. He's one of my favorites, too.
What a nice guy.
Such a mensch.
By the way, I have to say, I used to see him running on the track at UCLA. I ran with him. We never spoke, but, you know, when I was a student there. So.
He's probably not as fast as
No. No, he may have been marathon mad, but he really wasn't.
So the book, I think, resonated for people and continues to get passed around because, honestly, whether or not you're a celebrity, and most of us aren't, all of their stories were our stories. Everybody that's Jewish can see themselves in so many of these childhood, you know, memories and personal struggles and questions about marriage and questions about tradition and what you give your children or you don't. All those things are universal questions, and especially for Jews, I think it's kind of like any Jew tells our story. So the book kind of took off, and then a producer approached me and said, I think this could be a musical, and I said, I think you're crazy. And just to tell the condensed version, what we ended up doing was asking some of the most A-list composers if they would take the interviews, you know, look at the book and see which interview speaks to you, and you could write that song. So Sheldon Harnick, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof, wrote the song about Norman Lear. And Marvin Hamlisch collaborated with the Bergmans, Alan and Marilyn Bergman, who write all the hits for Barbara Streisand. I'd interviewed them for the book, and they collaborated on the Bergmans' own song. We had Duncan Sheik, who wrote Spring Awakening. He won the Tony Award for Spring Awakening. He wrote the Kenneth Cole chapter. They each took a chapter that spoke to them and wrote a song that they wanted to write, and we didn't give them any parameters, really. So that's really how it began, and now we're, whatever, 12-13 songs later. It was off-Broadway, not Broadway, unfortunately, but off-Broadway, which is pretty big in itself in New York, and produced by Daryl Roth, who has Kinky Boots on Broadway now. And it had its New York run, and now it's going around the country. It's opening in Florida this month, actually.
Wow. Well, I hope it goes everywhere.
Thank you. I hope so, too. From your lips to God's ears.
Yeah, that's what we say. I don't think it actually works like that, but I'll keep trying.
Okay.
In your 18 holidays, one wandering Jew, what's the most surprising thing you've experienced so far?
Such a good question. I think what's the most surprising thing is that I've drawn tremendous inspiration from every denomination. That, you know, I guess if you had to slot me, you'd put me in the Reform camp. I don't love those labels. I don't know how you feel about the labels, but I know a lot of people are invested in those lines and labels. And what I've done in this series very mindfully, intentionally, is to sort of get the wisdom from everywhere. So I've talked to Haredi Jews, and I've talked to Reform and Renewal and Reconstructionist and Conservative and Orthodox and Open Orthodox. And honestly, I don't say this in just a Pollyanna-ish way. I've learned from every one of them. I may not agree with every one of them. I may not necessarily want to worship the way they worship, but I really am not just inspired, but really transformed by the learning that I get from all of these different traditions or approaches to our tradition. And I wish in a way that we could talk to each other more. I wish that more people could have the experience I'm having. You know, as a journalist, I get licensed to call kind of any rabbi I want to, and pretty much every one of them has spent time with me that I ask. And, you know, it's such a delight to have these conversations, to say, tell me what Shemini Atzeret means in 2014. Why should we care about a holiday very few of us can explain? Or why should we fast 6 times? You know, fasting on Yom Kippur is hard enough. These kinds of things, you know, bringing the tradition alive today with all of these, I mean, it's your cohort, it's all of your colleagues. I see so much wisdom in so many of them. That's been the most eye-opening.
There's a great teaching in Pirkei Avot. It says, Mikom olam da hiskalti. I've learned from all of my students.
Oh, I love that.
I think that's what Judaism is really all about, and the whole diversity of it is beautifully explored. And as I said, your articles are not only interesting, but highly entertaining.
Thank you. And that's part of the point, too, is that people should have fun coming along with me. I didn't want this to feel like Judaism 101, and I didn't want it to be overly sober. So I don't, hopefully, I mean, I'm very respectful, and it's very dignified, but I'm also taking you through my prism. You know, this is Abby going through it, and you know, there's a certain wackiness to it all.
So speaking of wacky, you were in a musical that should have worked and didn't, and wrote a book about it, Merrily We Roll Along, a Sondheim musical. How could it fail? Tell us a little bit about that project and what it was like to, I don't know, I guess you wouldn't say kiss and tell, but what it was like to reveal that experience.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible. I was 16 years old, and I was in a Stephen Sondheim flop, and he really hadn't had a flop this big before then. You know, it's Stephen Sondheim, and he had A Little Night Music and Company and all the musicals we all love, and this was supposed to be a big success. I mean, there was a lot of build-up. Harold Prince was the director, and he's also a legend. Really, all of my heroes, and I was a musical theater addict as a kid, all my heroes kind of came to life.
You're not alone in that experience, by the way.
I know, and I mean, really, in that sense, this was an experience I would never obviously regret in any way, even though we crashed and burned, and we really did. I mean, we rehearsed, it was a very long audition process, and we rehearsed for a long time, and then we were in previews for a long time, and then we ran for 5 minutes. I mean, we had 16 performances, but it became its own legend. In a funny way, because the score is wonderful. The book of the musical, the script doesn't work as well, and many people have tried to fix it, and yeah, no one has quite managed it, although London just had a very good production 2 years ago. But it's just one of those legendary flops that people love to remember, and the cast has stayed in touch. It's amazing. I mean, I'm an old lady now at 49 years old, and I don't want to admit that, but it's true. And to look back and say that we're all still on Facebook together, and every time the anniversary comes around of our opening night, everyone kind of connects. It's pretty remarkable.
You worked for in production, not on the other side of the camera, for people like Fred Friendly, Charlie Rose, Bill Moyers, and then at 60 Minutes for Ed Bradley and Mike Wallace. Those are challenging jobs, no?
Those really were, as you said, I mean, they were the giants, or ours, quite a few of them are gone, sadly,
right,
of broadcast news. And I would say that that's where I learned sort of my journalistic bedrock values. You know, like, this is how you report a story fairly. This is how you get someone to bring a story to life. They were incredible teachers. I mean, that said, they weren't easy, necessarily, all of them, because giants, you know, are demanding and are, you know, they're not necessarily helping you along. I mean, they're teaching you, but you kind of have to sink or swim. So, you know, in the crucible of like a journalistic childhood, it was an amazing education. All of them really were.
So a totally different question. You do an interview program at the
JCC.
Famous JCC, right?
in Manhattan.
The 92nd Street Y, which is a JCC, I'm sorry, and the JCC in Manhattan. You've had all kinds of people. You've had a chance to interview many terrific and very talented people. Do you like being interviewed more, or do you like interviewing more?
That's such a good question. No one's ever asked me that. You know, I actually love interviewing people, but I'm one of those kind of type A annoying students who over-prepares, because I feel like, you know, if I sit down with Malcolm Gladwell or Nora Ephron, which I have, I want them to know that I've done
the
my
same
homework.
At the same time?
No, not at the same time.
That would be an interesting outlying comedic experience. I'm not sure what to say about that.
That's true. You know, I want them to feel like I've done my homework, because I feel like it allows the guest to relax, and I feel this way with you, when you know that they've sort of done the backstory and they're not starting from scratch. But that said, I always end up being kind of a stress case before every one of those interviews, and my children can attest to that. When I'm interviewed, it's, you know, the knowledge comes from me, so even though there's a little bit of nervousness, I don't have to prepare exactly the same way. So, you know, there's advantages to both. I mean, it's amazing to be at the JCC in Manhattan, because they have, you know, given me this wonderful opportunity. If I can get, I have to book the guests, but if I can get the guests, then they get the people in the door, and it's really a wonderful place to have these conversations.
I want to thank Abby Pogrebin for a fabulous visit here on Too Jewish. You can follow her articles in the foreword, which are utterly delightful. You can also find out more about her on her website, abigailpogrebin.com. And I wish you the best of luck with the show. May it return to Broadway not too long. Sometimes it works like that.
Thanks so much. It's been great to be with you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Professor Carmel Chiswick, exploring the economics of Judaism today. Extremely interesting. Our playout this morning comes from Safam. It's a reminder to keep smiling and preserve a positive mental attitude. My friends, may you be blessed with a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Took his boy to mountain climb. Wife thought it was